Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, October 13th. January 13th. I don't know where October came from. January 13th, 2025. Joining me in the studio today...
It's Peter R.H. and Stephen.
Stephen Fan.
Stephen's just back from Las Vegas, and he's going to be telling us about his adventures at the Consumer Electronics Show.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Peter, what do you got up for today?
Well, we had a... She didn't say anything, but she used to attend a few of the UBC Anarchist Club meetings, right, 4 years ago. Not so much as an anarchist, but as a progressive person.
Right.
I got a hold of her. I remembered her name.
And this is... she's going to be... Her name first.
April Page.
And she's going to be a new part-time participant in
the program? Hopefully. I think we talked on Sunday afternoon, and we thought maybe to take a bit more to... I have a written statement from her, which is usually it's not good to read things, but I'm going to do it in the interest of not editing, because you sort of change things in your editorial opinion of what... And I'm also going to maybe, because she was involved with something I wasn't in the 1980s, that was to establish, to have a crab park.
Right.
And which I, it's sort of interesting that we're not going to have the piece you did, we're going to have it, you're going to have it on later shows about the people that want to do the homeless encampment there.
Yeah.
I kind of saw... a little bit of phoniness in the 80s over kind of the whole Crab Park thing. I mean, she doesn't see it that way herself, but
right.
I kind of, because Jim Green was part of that campaign. And then about 20 years ago, he was against encampments there.
Right.
And I think they're, you know, anyway, so we'll be talking a bit about that and other things.
So that's coming later in the show. We're going to start off in a couple of minutes with a report from about the Comox Nation and an important milestone in their journey to self-government. And we also have a report, or an interview rather, from CJSF Danny Nesvaradani about Sterling Winters, who's a performance and voice coach here at SFU, and I think you'll learn some things a bit about being a better presenter. All that and more coming up here, right here on Speak Up Today. We're going to start off with this report from the Comox, from Comox on Vancouver Island about the Comox Nation's important step in appointing a justice of the peace. The first in Canada as part of their journey towards self-government.
On December 4th, 2024, Comox First Nation appointed Dr. Marion Buller as their Justice of the Peace, a first in First Nations history in Canada. This historic moment is the next step in a long journey for the Comox First Nation towards self-determination, building on previous steps like signing to the Framework Agreement in 2014 and voting to approve their land code in 2016. Chief Robert Louis of West Bank First Nation is chairman of the First Nations Land Advisory Board. The Land Advisory Board is an organization that works across Canada to support First Nations communities in their efforts to re-establish control over their lands, natural resources, and environment. One way is through land codes, a level of self-governance achieved by the Comox First Nation in 2016. Chief Louis spoke to CHLY about what it means to be a land code First Nation, how that led to this landmark moment, and what this means for the future of Comox First Nation, as well as other communities across the country.
Yes, a land code First Nation is a government decision maker. It has the community who passes a land code enters the realm of self-government. The parts of the Indian Act disappear and is replaced by the jurisdiction of the First Nation. So at least one-third of the Indian Act is no longer applicable to a First Nation with a land code.
Louis explains that this means the community, in this case Comox First Nation, governs what happens on their lands with full lawmaking capacity. Whether that be leasehold interest, dealing allotments to band members, how deep to put water and sewage lines, or how close to build to water sources.
Anything that affects lands, the community has that full decision-making capacity.
Comox First Nation is one of over 120 communities across Canada to pass land code, with the help of the Lands Advisory Board, Louis says.
This is what is happening across the country, and I know our team. We have a lands board of directors that are reflective of communities right across Canada. We've got resource center staff who, you know, work from Vancouver Island right through to Newfoundland, and so it's a really a good working feeling that yes, we must work together. Don't leave anybody behind.
While Comox First Nation are one of many to pass land code, they are the first to appoint a justice of the peace. Louis shares what it is that qualified Dr. Marion Buller to be the first.
And Dr. Buller is a First Nation member of the Mistawasis Cree First Nation in Saskatchewan and has achieved much in her career over 22 years as a provincial judge.
The Honorable Judge Marion Buller has nearly 40 years of legal expertise and was the first Indigenous woman to be appointed provincial court judge in BC in 1994. Judge Buller was instrumental in establishing the First Nations Court of British Columbia in 2006 and became Chief Commissioner of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls in 2016. She was appointed Chancellor of the University of Victoria in 2022.
So, you know, high accolades with her background and experience, obviously, there's no doubt that they've made a perfect choice for their justice of the peace.
To explain why this appointment was necessary, Chief Louis points out how Canadian laws all must have enforcement provisions, whether provincial, territorial, or federal.
So when you pass laws, they must be enforced.
Louis goes on to explain how a gap in the justice system has left an issue of recognition and implementation of First Nation laws by policing authorities, creating a gap in enforcement over the past few decades.
In the early days, and I'm going back to the early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s, and leading up to our agreement with Canada in our framework agreement, which Canada recognized the inherent rights of First Nations to be self-governing.
Louis describes how at the time they didn't realize there were gaps in Canada's enforcement system, such as the RCMP Police Act not providing clauses or clarity regarding the requirement of the RCMP to enforce First Nation laws.
So consequently, a gap has clearly developed, and policies sometimes intervene, and many communities have no issues with policing and RCMP. Other communities do. And so over time, we've realized that these are real significant issues.
The movement to self-governance evolved from the framework agreement to the passing of land codes at the turn of the millennium. Since then, the number has grown to over 120 communities across Canada with this self-government land management function, including Comox First Nation. But the gap in enforcement persists, as Chief Louis explains.
So the difference here is that while you have the general public having more clarity on how enforcement takes place, how prosecution takes place with First Nations, it's a growing understanding with various levels of government to enforce those laws. So consequently, Comox has had to challenge the laws and ensure their laws are enforced.
Louis shares how that very thing happened with a landmark case in 2018.
And so they were very successful here in 2018 with a landmark court case on trespass, a landlord-tenant situation where their laws, once passed, had to be enforced by the courts and by the RCMP.
Louis says this gap in the system is what led the Comox First Nation to their decision to appoint a Justice of the Peace, the first ever in Canadian First Nations history.
They have expertise now. So now, for them, It means that they have a justice of the peace who can now deal with offenses and implement things like restorative justice.
Louis defines restorative justice as including the victim, the offender, and, depending on the case, even community members, to work out alternative solutions to incarceration.
Here you have the potential of adding more of a traditional flavor to it, having elders circles in place, having sentencing that may be more unique to a community to reflect its own cultures and how they do things.
Louis speaks to why this system is so vital in First Nation communities.
Throughout Canada and BC, not excluded from that, there is a disproportionate number of incarceration of Indigenous peoples. And so it's helping to deal with things like that and helping now that there will be clarity on the enforcement and blending in of the First Nation cultures in the justice system.
Louis says that as Justice of the Peace, Buller will have her hands full, setting the precedent for how things will be done and managing disputes and challenges to laws with fairness and efficiency, providing everyone their right to proper access to the justice system.
And so now she now provides a framework for that justice system to occur and to better reflect enforcement of Comox laws and values and how they wish to move ahead in the in managing their lands and resources.
Louis speaks as well to what it means for Comox First Nation and other communities across the country to have this historic first.
And I suppose when you look at being the first in Canada, they've put history in motion. There always has to be that front end leader that takes the challenge and moves ahead.
Louis says that for Comox First Nation, this means they now have clarity that their laws must be upheld by the Canadian courts, providing comfort when they pass laws. He also says this is setting off a ripple effect to other communities across the country, considering what they can do to expand their own self-governance.
Many communities, not just in British Columbia, but other communities are now seriously looking at how they can further their justice systems and to get clarity on enforcement. So it's set a whole new different meaning to enforcement of First Nation laws.
For CHLY News, this is Heather Watson.
This report, in partnership with CVOX, was made possible with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs program, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is Bird Note. In some bird species, males and females look pretty different. For example, male northern cardinals are bright red, and females are mostly brown. In some species, the differences between sexes even help them eat different foods. In the group of hummingbird species called hermit hummingbirds, found in Central and South America, females typically have curved bills, while males have straighter ones. This makes the females better at drinking nectar from flowers with curved bases, while males visit flowers with straight bases. This could help males and females avoid directly competing for the same flowers. The Hispaniolan woodpecker from Haiti and the Dominican Republic also divvies up food resources based on bill size. In this species, males have the bigger bills. They spend more time pecking at bark and probing deep tree holes. Females usually pick at insects and spiders on the surface of leaves and bark. Both the females and males are capable of the same types of feeding. It's a difference in emphasis and how they spend their time. Adaptations like these help birds share space with each other. Avoiding competition has benefits for the whole species. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This time, Bird Note has excluded the United States also, but it's not even excluded to Canada.
Perhaps, maybe that's fair. We're back with Stephen Fan. He's just back from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is, well, tell us very briefly, what is the Consumer Electronics, often known as the CES?
So Consumer Electronics Show actually began in 1967. And originally, it was just that. It was Consumer Electronics. So traditionally, the biggest item in Consumer Electronics shows is television. Mm-hmm. So when it began in the 1960s, it would have been these huge cathode ray tubes. Yeah. And then so I think part of the reason the CES, that is now known, became cool is because there's been such a huge transformation in that core technology from these gigantic cathode ray tubes that cost $4,000 to.
And of course, we also had the emergence of computers and their spin-off technologies, which hugely diversified the sort of products that were being presented there.
Yeah, and I think that what really spun it into high gear was the emergence, as you said, of information technology, you know, all these tech giants. And this is a really surprising thing because people go to Consumer Electronics Show to really, quote-unquote, gawk at cool gizmos. Mm-hmm. But and that there's huge of that. There's 64 football fields worth of hardware exhibits and exhibits in general, just gizmos, nonstop, too much, really. But with there's also really a separate side of the CES, which is slightly smaller, but not much smaller, and that's all the tech giants. And what they're doing there is essentially negotiating all the advertising, the content deals, and stuff like that with the creators who tend to just kind of take it as a one-week kind of paid-for party. And they have, you know, if you go to the Aria Hotel right in the middle of Vegas, which is kind of the media side of things, there are literally thousands of corporate hospitality suites just booked up completely solid in the middle of the day. And there are all these like heralds and, you know, messengers running around for Google and directing people to their meetings. Mm-hmm. It's complete, you know, babble. It's insane. And it's just like it's the busiest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. So it's crazy, but it also shows kind of the side of the tech business, media business, that's often kind of not as noticed beside the cool gizmos. But there are a lot of cool gizmos. And
you have a bunch of them you want to talk about, or at least trends.
Well, I can try. Gizmo. I mean, there's a ton. So I'm going to actually start with something that was in the previous segment, which is birds. And one thing that was actually huge this year is kind of this kind of bird tech, bird feeders, really. And you might ask, why are bird feeders a hit? They just provide food for the birds. And actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because when you have a bird feeder in your yard, you know, you might not always catch a glimpse of the bird. But with a little bit of a tech, like, you know, kind of disguised cameras, kind of intelligent kind of trail cam kind of setup, you can basically capture really good photos of the birds with like cameras like littered throughout your yards. And sometimes these things are disguised as flowers in bright colors. It's pretty cool. And the appeal of this technology is really kind of it's cheap, it's easy, and it's a kind of a big gain without too much of a cost. But I guess kind of in that line, I think what's interesting this year at CES is that, you know, for the past 2 years, everyone's been talking nonstop about AI, LLM, and deep learning, and all that stuff. And actually, I think everyone's a little bit tired of it at CES. Like, if you go to the talks by tech insiders, like, you know, the talk by the Facebook CMO, mostly people are not really talking about, you know, AI writing emails for you. I think one thing that's actually struck me as a better, much more interesting use of the AI, and that's much more promising in the future, if you just walk around the exhibits, there's so many robot exhibits that are now plausible because of AI. Because the robots is kind of like a very Jetsons kind of an idea. You know, you have the robot servants and stuff like that. I don't think we're quite there yet, and we might never be. But one thing that has become a lot more plausible in the robot world is that you can have, you know, very affordable actuators, which is kind of the things that connect all the segments of the robots. That's the hardware side. And you can also do really cheap and fast training of the robots to, let's say, walk naturally or wash your dishes or potentially cook some food with kind of AI neural nets. And that's just something that's become a lot more affordable and accessible now compared to a couple of years ago. So, like, you know, the robot exhibits are like, you know, you walk around the floor, it's like 50% from China, 30% from Korea, 20% from everyone.
And are these primarily humanoid-type robots?
So that's the interesting question. No. The answer is humanoid robots are probably, in many ways, not where the future is primarily going, because humanoid robots have a very physical limitation, which is that they have to walk on 2 feet.
Yeah.
And it turns out bipedalism is shockingly difficult for robots. Like, it's so insanely difficult that the entry-level humanoid robot by Unitree, which is like one of the top two robot makers in the world, cost $18,000 or $27,000 US in the United States.
Yep.
And an entry-level four-legged with wheels, like a four-legged dog robot, costs $1,600. So an order of magnitude difference.
Right.
So just bipedalism is an incredibly challenging thing. There are actually a lot of really rapid advances to make the walking gait seem more natural and, you know, not tip over all the time. But these things will always remain.
So you mean instead of legs, you would have wheels, basically?
So actually, this is the other thing. So I think this is the other trend in robotics, that robot dogs, because they have four legs, were kind of always a convenient typology for robots. But people started with legs. You know, legs are kind of a cool, looks natural. But I think where things are going is with wheels. And why I say that is that Unitree, again, one of the top two robot makers in the world, they released a video in December of their new robot dog with wheels. This is like their top-end industrial model. It costs $100,000. You can't really buy it as a consumer. But the wheels go up really fast. And it's so designed that you can throw it from a wall 2 meters high, and it's totally fine. It flips itself over, keeps going. It climb up and down stairs. And this is the most important thing: it could carry a human.
All right.
So you can't really ever design a robot dog with traditional feet that can carry a human. It's just way too difficult. But like robot dogs with four wheels, you're basically combining a robot with a mobility scooter.
Mm-hmm.
And at some price point, that would be valuable for the consumer.
Well, you know, a mobility scooter or a mobility wheelchair are already hugely expensive.
Yeah.
And right? So we're not talking about getting down to hundreds of dollars necessarily in that context.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? And one of the most interesting pieces of technology I saw this year was actually a company called Strut, which makes intelligent wheelchairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of it is that they would navigate around bumps and hazards and so forth, obstacles. And I tried it on the floor, actually. The first thing I noticed about their wheelchair is that it's incredibly sleek. It's like in this all black, you know, like metal and stuff. And it's really fast. The power is huge. I don't know how good their obstacle avoidance thing is, because it's a flat floor with no obstacles. But it looks pretty cool. People were raving about it. I don't know to what extent the tech will get applied, but I think some version of it will sort of start to flow out, because there's a lot of tech actually that will have implications for accessibility. There is a set of smart glasses which will actually beam information directly into your eyes from a light. And there is a set of VR glasses which can help people with very severely reduced sight.
Yeah.
I was speaking with a guy, a very chipper Aussie guy at an audio booth. So it's an Australian company, but collaborating with a Chinese company making audio equipment. And what's sort of interesting is that, you know, like there are hearing aids, right?
Yeah.
But like your hearing aid, you know, traditionally, it tries to magnify the stuff it hears in an environment. But a lot of the times, let's say in an airport or evacuation setting, it's just a lot easier if you can have a central source of information that beams to your hearing aid. And it's not because it can't connect to Wi-Fi or Bluetooth and like that. It requires a special form of hearing, sort of like connection technology, which was not widely adopted.
Right.
But it looks like there's going to be a different kind of hearing aid coming along, and that would have previously cost $20,000, and now it's $200.
Right.
And you can wear that hearing aid, and it could either magnify what's immediately in your environment, or there can be a central source beaming to it if you choose.
Communicating
and just telling you, like at the airport, telling you what's the departures, or you need to evacuate, or stuff like that. So I think all these accessibility tech, I think, is actually super, super fascinating.
Well, I even saw a report recently that Apple has done an update for their AirPods, which allows them to be used as hearing aids.
Yes, that's true. And I do think that, that's going to be a huge game changer because it's going to make hearing aids much more affordable. Mm-hmm. I think this is the kind of the next step where you're making hearing aids not just having to pick up sort of sound in the environment, which is not might not be easy to translate in that direction, but also just having like much better signal that just comes straight from a source that you can just use.
I could see that highly applicable, not even outside of the hearing aid space, because people often wear their AirPods a lot. You're at the airport.
Yeah.
It's like you're listening to your music. Maybe you're missing out on things you need to know. Whereas if it beam, you know, you could, I imagine eventually once you book your flight, it's going to beam you specifically information about your flight and not everything.
Yeah, so the technology, it's really a protocol. It's really a signaling protocol between these devices, and it already exists in hospitals and stuff like that. But what I think the new change is really just making it down to like the $200 level instead of like the $20,000 medical grade level, right? So I think that could be a big deal for people who are accessibility challenged.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so we don't have unlimited time, so let's jump on to some other things that you saw there.
Yeah, so the other things I saw are, you know, like, you know, AI, obviously everyone talks about AI. There's, you know, display tech. So everyone always talks about newer and bigger TVs. Mm-hmm. I think normal people don't find it super interesting, but there is one new TV tech that's coming online, and that's kind of, it's the first consumer micro LED TV. So it's worth explaining very quickly what that is. Micro LED TV is not like a traditional TV where you have pixels and then you have a backlight beaming into your eyes. And micro LED TV is that every single light source is just a pixel.
So each pixel is its own light source.
You can turn on and off individual pixels. So in theory, this creates infinite contrast. If you do it with LEDs, it's potentially really, really bright. So OLED is a version of this, but OLED is done with organic materials, which is much harder to control. It's just not as good. Micro LED is something that the industry has been working on for 20, 30 years. It's never paid off in consumer contexts, but this time Hisense and Samsung are both rolling out a consumer version of it. Mm-hmm. I say consumer version, but it's still going to cost $70,000 for their 136-inch version from Hisense. But obviously,
well, 136-inch is a huge television.
Yeah, so for like their base model, like 70 inches, that's going to be like $9,000 or something like that. So it's still expensive, but it's going to come down.
But it will come down, because when flat screens first appeared, they were also in that price range for much smaller TVs. And then, of course, now, you know, a 55-inch TV is under $500.
And the most hilarious thing about, you know, the 136-inch Hisense, whatever, is that it's not going to ship as one piece. They're going to ship it as a frame and 25 panels. And this is also the fun thing about micro LED TVs is that they're infinitely expendable. Because it goes edge to edge, you can just put however many panels you want. Right. It's not one big panel. You're not worried if that one pixel dies, you have to replace the entire panel. You just take the small panel, rip it out, put in a new one. Yeah. So the TV is becoming a lot more modular and replaceable as well. In other display tech, you know, people have always been talking about VR, AR, XR. You know, like the look up glasses. Let's go right in your eyes. I tried one from the company called Rokit this time. They're based in Hangzhou, and they're one of the, I think, top three AR glasses makers in the world. It's really cool this time because they've built, you know, this cool like 200-inch screen right in your glasses. But they've also now integrated kind of an Android controller that basically replaces your phone. And it's actually very intuitive. It used to be that AR glasses, the only real usage is connecting it to your laptop so it replaces your screen. Right. But now it's kind of its own system, and it retails for $699 US starting in February. It ships in February. It's not cheap, but it's also not like completely out of the range of what consumers could afford for this kind of a thing. Yep. So I think that could potentially be really interesting to see if it takes off. So like there's kind of a ton of stuff. Let me see if there's anything else. Projectors, I don't think people care about projectors. Although I got a free one, that was very nice. Vacuums, this is the really last thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Vacuums is huge this time. This is at XES. There's like 50 different smart vacuums. But I'm going to talk about the most fun one, which is that there's a vacuum, and everyone's talked about this, vacuum with a robotic extendable arm that goes right from the middle of the vacuum, and then it just picks up stray socks and items and toys, whole idea is that what's been stopping vacuums, automatic robotic vacuums, from being effective is obstacles on the floor.
Right.
But if you can just literally have a robotic arm that picks up things and deposits in a predesignated,
moves them out of the way.
Everyone loved it. It was crazy. Everyone loved this. So, like, I think next year we're gonna see like 30 different robotic arm